Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. The numbers in this episode that we're going to be talking about are the top 300 trades, graphic novels, hardcovers, collected editions, yada, 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 for June 2015 as invoiced from Diamond to retailers in the direct market in North America. Now, Drew, I just got back from San Diego Comic-Con. Not Drew, I'm sorry, TJ, I am completely fried.
That's okay, I understand.
You think this is bad. You should see me at Comic-Con. My eyes practically glaze over the minute I walk in the convention center. It is huge. It is big. And as fun as these numbers are, I would love to know if there was some magic way to tally it up. In those 4.5 days, you know, the 4 full days, the preview night, what volume of units and dollars changed hands, just, you know, in terms of comics and trades, to readers?
Mm-hmm.
And I want to be clear on that part because I'm sure there are a lot of dealer-to-dealer sales going on there too.
Mm-hmm.
But all of the sales that happen – let me be clear on this. Most of – some of the sales, a portion of the sales, let's go with that, that happen on there are not data we're going to see here.
Absolutely.
Anything that, say, Image or some of these other publishers, you know, Boom, Dark Horse, whatever – are selling directly to readers, we see none of that. Now, there are other sales that happened during that convention that we kind of got a glimpse of at one point. Torpedo Comics, at this point, shows up and has just a bazillion trades and stuff that they typically... I didn't actually pay much attention this year, but last year it was like 50% off or everything.
Mm-hmm.
So those are sales that at some point, presumably... went through Diamond to some retailer that maybe changed hands a time or two to get to Torpedo to get blown out that way. Or maybe Torpedo got them directly from Diamond. I don't know. But those are the sorts of sales, the ones that happen from an actual retailer of some sort, because there are a fair number of brick-and-mortar retailers and online retailers that show up at Comic-Con. Those are the sorts of things we might see in these numbers. But there's also, I think, a huge spike in sales, not in the Diamond numbers that happen at Comic-Con and at some of the, you know, New York Comic-Con, C2E2, the Toronto convention and some of the other major conventions, plus all the little tinier ones, you know, around the country, around the world. We just don't have visibility into that.
No, I think that's a really good point. You know, I've only been to a few cons. You know, I live in Arizona and so I've been to the Phoenix Comic-Con and I am struck by how many, you know, different retailers are that seem to specialize in traveling from con to con, and they sell, you know, kind of like, you know, bin diving comics, you know, 10 cent quarter all the way up to, you know, $5-$10. And then they also have tons of trades. And it seems like they don't even have a store almost. They just do a lot of that business. So it is interesting to see, it would be interesting to see where they got their inventory from and how they do in terms of the amount they're able to move.
Well, and with those, I mean, that's a particular niche of retailers that I find very interesting and I think provide a huge service for the community,
mm-hmm.
in so much as I don't know where they acquire their stock to blow out or whatever, be it from stores that have gone out or just buying collections or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But these are the guys that are physically moving comics from one geographical location to another. So suppose you're trying to hunt down that one elusive issue of Kickers Inc. from the New Universe.
Mm-hmm.
That's all you need to complete your New Universe collection, but you've pretty much tapped out your local stores and stuff. You need people like that to come to a convention near you, or you go to a convention that they're at, because they've hit some other geographical area and might have found that one copy, you know, still out there floating around to complete that wonderful run of Kickers Inc. or, you know, whatever. And I use that kind of facetiously because I don't think anyone's really looking for that series. But there comes a point where, you know, I could go hit the local stores here in town and either they've got what I want and I buy it or they don't, which is part of why I tend to go to, you know, mycomicshop.com for my back issue stuff. It's just they've got a great selection. It's because they've bought from so many retailers, collections and stuff over the years, them, Mile High Comics, and a few other places are just a better hit ratio for back issues.
Mm-hmm. I actually tend to agree, but I've been trained, you know, over time to be an online buyer, obviously mostly through shopping through DCBS and in-stock trade. Mm-hmm. So I have no problem shopping like that. But there is a significant portion of the comic buying community that really likes to hold the issue in their hand and look at it, look at the grade, you know, in their head, at least the grade. You know, we can get into how grading is so subjective, but they like to look at it and see if they, you know, if they can get themselves a bargain. And so I think, you know, as much as I would expect a lot of that sales volume to go online, and maybe a lot of it has, I still think that there's a significant market for people who kind of like bargain hunt at cons, or part of it is just the fun of finding something interesting, you know?
Oh, absolutely. And that's a great point, because those, I mean, there's, to me, those are more collector people than readers.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say they don't also read the comics. Obviously they do. Otherwise, why would they get them? But certainly if you're going for an older, you know, or a vintage comic or whatever, you want something in, if you're caring about the grade for some of that stuff, there are certain books I would be very reluctant to buy online for that same reason.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, it's just, hey, I just need a copy of this to fill out my run.
Mm-hmm.
I tend to order, you know, very fine or better when I do stuff at mycomicshop.com. Mm-hmm. But I've heard horror stories from some other online places where there were tears in the cover, there were other things, that if you read carefully the grading at that online store, that's considered acceptable for a surprisingly high-grade comic or something.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a time and a place where getting your hands on the copy, you know, just to eyeball it yourself and say, is this acceptable to me? Absolutely. And again, conventions are an excellent place for that, particularly one like San Diego that has so many people doing, again, the higher end, older comics and stuff. But to me, it's that 80s, 90s, and the early, you know, 2000s and stuff. There's a period of time there where the comics aren't rare enough, in demand enough, or old enough that it's for it to be worth people bringing to a convention, unless it's just, hey, I've got, you know, this metric ton of comics that I'm putting out on my booth. Come paw through it and see what you see, you know. And again, that's, I'd be hard pressed to name other big online dealers other than Mile High or My Comic Shop, mainly because I haven't looked that hard for that. I'm not that much into the back issues by and large. I've got more than enough of them.
Yeah. And as for me, I use primarily, especially for much older comics that, you know, are way out of my price range, or just I don't want to take the time to track down. I read those digitally, either through the Marvel Unlimited app or on Comixology. They have a lot of, you know, of the backlist, you know, 60s, 70s, 80s, especially mm-hmm. big two digitized. So,
yeah, well, and I think that's changing the game considerably in comics, not just in terms of back issues, because I believe there was a panel at Comic-Con this year about should stores have back issues or not. Mm-hmm. Or are they coming back? Or yeah, I don't know the exact gist. I didn't make it to the panel. But I think that applies very much to the discussion we have every month on the trade side, because that's the other way to get stories that you miss the individual issue of, you know, get the collected edition.
Mm-hmm.
And I think certainly digital has, I don't want to say filled that void, because it really hasn't, but it's supplemented it in a very interesting way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you missed an issue of, say, The Walking Dead, and your store just is out and can't get another copy for whatever silly reason, which seems unlikely, but who knows, maybe it could happen. You could just get that one online, continue reading, and hunt it down later as a back issue, or just be fine reading it digitally, or get the collected edition, what have you. But it, to me, acts as a safety net for comics.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's got an unlimited virtual supply.
Yeah. And I think the other nice thing is that you're able to not worry. From the publisher's perspective, sometimes taking risk on collecting in, you know, hardback or paperback stuff from the 60s, 70s, or 80s, you have to be very careful about your print run numbers and things like that in terms of, you know, are there enough fans out there that want to read this material? Because I'm going to be honest with you. Sometimes when I read comics from the 1960s and 70s, they're way too wordy for me. And some of the stories are just, and maybe I'm just not able to, you know, appreciate the time of the storytelling, but some of the stuff I've read from them is pretty lame. And maybe that's because I've grown up in modern comics, but I find some of that older stuff hard to read. And so when the publishers put this stuff out in collected forms for trades and paperbacks, there's a risk of them not selling a lot that is really minimized by digital, because there should be almost no overhead costs for digital, and it can continuously sell, and you don't have to worry about stock, you don't have to worry about things like that.
Well, and that brings up the point of Marvel's Digital Comics Unlimited being something, if you're toying around with, I really love the comics I'm reading today from Marvel, but I want to go and explore the back history and get back issues and such. You know, before you dive too deep into that, and by which I mean not by buying a lot, but by going further back in time, I would really urge somebody to get the Digital Comics Unlimited for even just a month or two.
Yeah.
And go read comics from particular time frames.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go read Fantastic Four, X-Men, Avengers, whichever title you're crazy about, from, and just do it like, pick issues on a 5-year gap basis.
Yeah.
Because you're going to find a point where, at least for me, I go so far back and then it's, you know, the storytelling here is just not to my liking.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of that. You know, I'm a pretty big, you know, Jason Aaron's, you know, recent version of Thor.
Mm-hmm.
I was such a big fan of that. It's kind of what got me back into reading Thor. So I went back to the, you know, original, what was it, mystery series, like the very first issues of Thor.
Journey into Mystery.
So hard to read. The art was great. Believe me, I didn't have a problem with the art, but it was so painful to read those.
Well, it's funny because I've read some of those in reprints and stuff, and I find some of that early Thor, Captain America, and stuff like that, Nick Fury and stuff, easy to read. It's a different style, don't get me wrong.
Yeah.
But then there comes a point a little later than that where the storytelling has shifted enough, it's a little more melodramatic or soap opera-y or whatever. And, I mean, how many times have you heard somebody say, I hit the Marvel stuff of the 90s and just got out of comics?
Yeah, that's true, especially for, like, the X-Universe.
And it's different people have different styles and sensibilities, both in terms of what they write and what they read.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so if again, you're planning on diving into back issues and stuff, it's not a matter of go so far back, hit one you don't like and stop, but figure out what time frame you're comfortable with the style of.
Mm-hmm.
And again, particularly at Marvel, there was a bit more, I don't say of a house style, but a flavor and consistency based on who was the editor in chief and some stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of those things that, particularly now with like the Epic Collection and stuff like that from Marvel, they're starting to get a lot of that into print. And I think digital is helping that out in so much as they've got to prep the stuff digitally anyways. This way, as they're doing it, they can be kind of, you know, amortizing that cost by recouping it by selling it digitally. But also, it's hard to package certain eras of comics into convenient trades.
Uh-huh.
Just because there's not as many clean entry and exit points.
I completely agree. One of the series that I kind of got bogged down reading, I actually checked these big chunky trade paperbacks out of the library, and we've talked a little bit about this in the past, or I've heard you talk about it, was the Clone Saga and during Spider-Man, and how part of the reason why that was so long and drawn out was because it was selling well, and instead of keeping the story tight, the editor's like, well, just start new series and add it in and keep adding more and more and more. And you know, there's like two or three like 600 page trades to read that entire saga.
Oh yeah, the thing is huge. And the Life of Riley was a website. Oh, yeah. I found at one point,
yeah,
kind of detailing some of the behind the scenes stuff where it's like, hey, this was going to go for, you know, 6 months or whatever, I forget how long. And it's like marketing came over, sales came over and said, you know, this is working, keep going.
Yeah.
And they went for like another few years, it felt like.
Yeah.
And I mean, some people thought that was a horrendous point of Spider-Man. Personally, I thought it was the shot in the arm that the stuff needed at the time.
Mm-hmm.
So again, different things for different people. But it's, again, that's a fascinating part of the industry to me in search in terms of what they collect, when they collect it, how they collect it, who buys it, when, and sort of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
I totally agree, because that stuff came a little bit before I started reading comics. And in comparison, I was really started reading comics right around the time when Carnage was introduced. And I was a huge fan of all that Carnage, Venom, Spider-Man, you know, all those stories. And I love that. And now when I look back at that, that might have been drawn out too. But when I was in it, when I was reading it as a kid, I loved that stuff.
When you started reading comics, were trade paperbacks common and ubiquitous kind of like they are today or not so much?
No, not at all. I started reading about, I want to say, 1996, so there weren't trades weren't a big thing.
All right. They were kind of around-ish, but yeah.
And I should say they weren't a thing at the store that I frequented, and that was the only comic store that was within it with 20 miles of my house. And I, you know, when I started reading comics was 15, 16, and so I didn't really have my own car. And the shop that I started at was literally like if I jumped two fences behind my house, I was at the shopping center. So I could just walk around the block and it was there. So
that's cool. I when I was a kid, I had to take the bus and it was, you know, cross town or whatever.
Yeah.
But yeah. All right, so looking at the top 300 for June, Marvel came out on top on the trade side. Wow, what a shock. I mean, two out of three, every 3 months, they do this.
Mm-hmm.
Or two-thirds of the time, I think is the better way to phrase it on average. They had, by units, 34.55% of the total sales, compared to Image, which had 25.44%. DC had 21.98% of the units. It looks a little bit different, though, if you look at the sales by retail dollars and split the percent of the top 300 that way. Marvel has a much more commanding lead with 43.74% of the total retail dollars for the top 300 trades. DC is in second place with 22.36% of those retail dollars. And Image in a bit of a distant third with 16.02% of the retail dollars for the top 300. Now, that, of course, is reflecting a much, much lower average price for Image's trades on the list this time around of $13.24 compared to DC's average price of $22.36 and Marvel's $27.05 average price.
Yeah, and it's also interesting that Marvel, the total items they put out was 107 for this month compared to 60 for Image and 62 for DC. That is quite a bit of difference.
Well, and again, a lot of that, I mean, they had almost, 29 new items, but 78 reorder items.
Yeah.
And it kind of raises the question of, was that perhaps one of the brilliant marketing and sales moves with Secret Wars, having it allude all of their past event titles.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Because if we look over at the list, there's a fair number of them on it this time around of, you know, hey, House of M or Civil War or, you know, what have you.
Yeah.
So I think that was certainly part of it. But also, you know, Marvel tends to do fairly well. Hang on, let me double check one thing. I think I said Marvel usually gets it. DC.
Yeah.
Two out of three times is the one on top. Marvel's only the third.
Yeah, I think you do bring up a really good point, is that part of the whole idea of the Battle World is kind of revisiting a lot of their past great events, or in their mind, great events at least. Maybe not all the fans thought they were great, but the worlds that they created with those events. And so I'm looking at some of the retail rank versus quantity rank for some of these, and maybe the discount was a little bit sweeter to get people to reorder these and have them in stock. So when people start reading the current stuff and they say, wow, man, I remember how great that was. Maybe I should go back and buy that trade again. They have them in stock.
Oh, absolutely. And it's a smart move, even if you're blowing them out just to get them out of inventory so you don't got to pay tax on that or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the fact that we're seeing, you know, Infinity Gauntlet, Civil War. Let me filter the list by Marvel real quick. Old Man Logan, a lot of the Marvel Zombie stuff, Secret Wars, Siege, Age of Ultron, House of M, Iron Man and the Armor Wars, Planet Hulk. I mean, there's a fair number of their past event stuff that's collected that's shown back up. And in some cases, the retail ranking is amazing, to be honest, in terms of there's one or two of these things, like the Iron Man Extremis with Motion Comic DVD down at rank 244. The retail rank is 1,669.
That's quite a discount they're giving for that.
Yeah. Now, that's one copy. No, hang on. Let me say it's a couple of copies more than Marvel Zombies number 4 hardcover, which had a retail rank of 898, which is just a couple of and that had the Extremis had a $25 price tag, Marvel Zombies had a $20 price tag. You know, the next closest thing below it that had a $24.99 price tag was House of M, retail rank of 176, and then above it would be, I mean, it's one of those things, some of these, well, again, just to refresh people's memories, the quantity rank is just how did it sell? The first is the bestseller, second's the next bestseller, etc. The retail rank is the same sort of ranking, but instead of being based on the number of units, it's based on the invoiced amount. Now, that's different than taking the number of units times the cover price. That's kind of the extended price and what one might expect the retail rank to be. But, obviously, these stores don't pay full price, otherwise they wouldn't make any money. They'd go out of business, we'd be out of comics, and that would suck. So, Diamond and the publishers are very nice. They let them, you know, discount the stuff to the stores so they can mark it back up and make some money. Not much money, but some money.
Mm-hmm.
And that invoiced amount is what does the retail ranking. So, in a simplistic world, if everything had the same price, the retail rankings would kind of go in line with the quantity rankings unless something was really massively discounted. You know, or again, the other thing is if the price is different and that's some of it here. But yeah, we've got a couple of things where the amount being made on this is incredibly low. Just because, again, some of this is perhaps older stuff they just had too much of and they were better off blowing it out and kind of meeting, I don't say the perceived demand or whatever, but again, it's a supply and demand thing. If you've got more supply and you've got demand, you know, get the stuff, move it at whatever you can.
Mm-hmm.
And again, those sorts of quantity or retail ranking things that are so high, those are the kinds of items I would expect a place like Torpedo or some other place to pick up these trades at a steal so they can then mark them off at 50%, giving it to the readers at a really good price and still making money. There was one point where it was starting to look like retailers may have simply overordered on things, and that's why we were seeing a lot of stuff getting blown out, kind of as cutting their losses sort of a thing in the retail community. You know, fortunately, that doesn't seem to be the case, but part and parcel with that is we've also got a lot lower sales, I think, overall, or on average, I should say, than we did at one point.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that's really interesting on the list this time around is if you look at the top 10, there's one thing you don't see in there, a DC comic.
That's true.
It is.
They don't show up till number 11.
Image and Marvel, mm-hmm. Almost trading slots on the list that way. The trade paperback for Witches Volume 1 topped the list with 8,946 units. Marvel's top-selling item was the Thanos Infinity Relativity OGN, original graphic novel hardcover, 7,864 units. I think I've got that sitting over on the bookcase in the incredibly large pile of things I need to read. And at the very least, if I don't read them, I need to shuffle them a little less that increasingly precarious pile of stuff tip over.
Yeah, I don't want to read a news article about you being killed by your comic collection there, John.
Neither do I. I am so glad I don't live in earthquake country anymore. Growing up in San Diego, this would have been a huge risk.
Yeah. You stack those boxes too high.
Well, the boxes are doing okay. It's just I've been getting a bit more of the trade paperbacks and digests and hardcovers. And what I've been doing over the last couple of months, because I've been we've been busy traveling and podcasting and, you know, work and all that stuff, is I've got a bookcase. I just set it down on top, and I get another one. I put another stack there. And again, that's gotten fairly high and not as well balanced as perhaps it should be. It's something to put on my to-do list.
Yeah, the one that's a page and a half long.
Pretty much. So the fact that Marvel and Image are doing better than the DC stuff, not really a big surprise to me, actually. The fact that four of those items are reorder with the Ms. Marvel Volume 3 trade paperback, Civil War, and Volumes 1 and 4 of Saga. There it ranks, 4 through 7.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, they've got reorder activity that's over at Marvel and Image outpacing even the new stuff at DC. But DC's top item is Deathstroke Volume 1 Gods of War, which is reorder activity.
Yeah, and that doesn't strike me as the type of title that will be in this list for very long.
It surprises me, actually, that we've got reorder activity on it at all, because it strikes me as the kind of title that would show up and vanish.
Yeah, that's exactly what I meant. I mean, Deathstroke, I can understand why some people like it, but he's not an A-level character that I would think that huge amounts of people are interested in.
Even if you go with he's got a higher profile thanks to the Arrow TV show and whatnot, this is a fairly mid-list title over at DC, I would say. I'm going over to the comics side to go filter the list and see really where. Yeah, mid-list, I think, is a very good way to put it. It's 38,807 over on the comics side. So about as many DC titles above it as below it. So for that to have been their top-selling trade, you know, in June, a little odd. But some of that is just kind of luck of the draw of whatever else they released that time around.
Yeah, that's true.
But they've got, like, the Grayson Volume 1 hardcover down at rank 24. That did 2,619 units. What else do we have in terms of new material from DC?
The Gotham Academy at number 13, Volume 1, first month on the chart.
That one, actually, I would say, even though it's only about 222 units below where Deathstroke did, is surprisingly high.
Yeah, it's true.
Given it's set in Gotham, but it doesn't really have any known characters.
Yeah, the reason I highlighted it is it's because it's one of the, in the Bat universe, the editor there, I've forgotten his name, has kind of been pushing, you know, with the new Batgirl, the new this Gotham Academy, and a few other series, he's been trying to definitely attract a different type of reader, and Gotham Academy is one of the main books that he's trying to do that with. I'm not saying he's going to be successful, but he is trying, and that is a very different book in the Bat universe than we're used to, and it is interesting to see it make the list.
Oh, absolutely, and for it to be the top-selling new book in new trade or whatever for DC in June implies it is working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it did better than, again, let me filter out the reorder activity here, see, that shrinks the list for DC way down to about 18 items. But again, it beat out the hardcover for Grayson Volume 1 and Batman and Robin Volume 6, Hunt for Robin hardcover, Batman and Robin Volume 5 trade paperback, Red Hood and the Outlaws trade paperback. I mean, there's some other stuff in here. Then you start getting into some older stuff. Aquaman and the Others, Volume 2, Alignment Earth, trade paperback, 1,334 units. I wonder why they ended that title. It's just not particularly robust sales on the trade side. So I'm really curious how things are going to go for DC over the kind of the second half of the year. They're having some stuff working out, Batgirl, Gotham Academy, and whatnot. They've certainly added a bunch of titles that are in that more... we'll go for the diversity push, I guess, would be the way to phrase it. Both in terms of the characters they feature, but also the audiences they're going after. You know, Batmite, Bizarro, Prez, Section 8, they're totally targeting a casting a wider net for the audience they're trying to go after.
Yeah, no, I think they've, for certain books, that the tone is different, the audience they're kind of, you know, orienting the stories around are different. The characters in the books are a little bit different. Like you said, I mean, I have never read a Batmite book, and I'm definitely going to at least give the first trade of that a try. So,
well, and I think that one's a mini series, isn't it?
I believe so. Yeah.
So there may just be the thing, and it's a smart move. Do it as a mini series. That way, if it doesn't catch on, hey, you know, no loss of face, no harm, no foul. Get the trade out of it. Move on. Versus when they put out Clarion, making it sound like it was an ongoing, and then kill it after six issues.
Yeah.
You know, there's a certain amount of presentation and perception around all that kind of stuff. And I appreciate that they're trying to get other people into comics and stuff, but, you know, at Comic-Con, I went to the DC booth. Granted, I did it late in the convention because, I mean, it was essentially the center of the booth. They've got one of the larger booths at Comic-Con. It's like, I don't know, 50 feet by 80 feet-ish. I could be a bit off on that, but roughly that big. And in the center of it was a bunch of displays of the costumes from the various movies and TV shows. You know, and it's cool, but walking in there, it was clearly a DC Entertainment booth, not a DC Comics booth. And that's a change that they've only made in the last few years, whereas it's definitely been that way for quite a few years since Marvel started returned to having a booth over at Comic-Con, because they had a few years where they didn't have one at all for Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes towards different focus for the company. And of course, that's now that they're, you know, fully moved into Burbank and stuff, a huge opportunity for them if they can take these characters, leverage them in these other mediums, and then find a way to get those audience, that audience to kind of circle back into comics, where they can then use them to test out new concepts, new ideas, Prez, Batmite, whatever, and then spin those out into a wider audience and stuff.
But that makes sense.
It does feel like at times we're a bit of a guinea pig audience almost. And I don't mean that in a bad way. But if it wasn't for iZombie having been done at Vertigo, I don't know that we would be getting an iZombie TV show.
Yeah, that's true.
And one of the things that did impress me at DC's booth was they had, both there and at the Warner Brothers stuff, an image that had Arrow, Flash, iZombie, Legends of Tomorrow, Gotham, Supergirl, and Lucifer. Seven TV shows. There are only 7 days of the week. Could we ever have expected to have that many comic book-based shows from a single publisher on in the same season?
Well, and the crazier thing is most of the networks do not program original programming on Saturday anymore. So you're looking at 6 days a week, too. So
yeah, true. So that's part of why I'm so behind on stuff. There's too much TV to watch.
Oh, that is something that has definitely fallen. I've fallen behind. There's so much TV on because I watch quite a few other stuff outside the superhero genre. And, you know, I try to keep up on my comics because that's like when you fall behind in comics, it just is really hard to catch up. And so a lot of times I just, you know, miss whole seasons of TV show and go, well, it's on the DVR. If I can ever get to it, I'll get to it.
Periodically, my sister and I will marathon through what's on the DVR just to catch up.
Yeah. Yeah, you have those one of those days off where you're like, well, I could watch six episodes of this right now.
Yeah, we actually did that the other night. Got behind on Rizzoli and Isles.
Uh-huh.
We like a decent mystery show or whatever, and it's kind of fun. But I know what you mean about being behind on the comics, because again, I've got a box and three quarters, that short box and three quarters I'm going through. I've made some progress. But I think that's also where trades fill a very interesting niche in the overall marketplace for the readers. Is I know a lot of people, if they got as far behind as I did, which granted is only a month or two, if they had that big of a stack, they would say, well, clearly I'm not liking this, that, and the other. I should drop everything except for the ones they feel they like the most, which is not a bad plan. What I have found, though, is when talking to people who go through that kind of a process, typically if they go through, because one of the last times I was so far behind, it's like, okay, I'm judging everything as I do it. I'm doing title by title, not week by week. But that way it's like I've got X copies, X issues of title X. Did I like it or not? Do I like it enough to keep going with it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, versus, well, I haven't read it, therefore it must suck, versus it's been long enough since you read it. Do you remember what you thought of it?
It's a good point.
And even if people read less than I do, and let's face it, most do, that doesn't mean they're going to remember something they read 7 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but if you then go through the story arc that came out in the meanwhile and determine, you know, if you go in with the goal of judging, do you continue with it or not? That just makes sense. But with trades, people can cut over from the monthly to the trade or vice versa. And it allows them to stagger their reading as they want to. And certainly these days with everything and its dog coming out in collected edition, I think it's a potentially viable way to do it. But I'm also curious about the cadence of releases and how that would go kind of budget-wise. Were I to say, hey, I'm not doing comics, I'm doing flipping over to trades, would I hit some months like this where DC really didn't have any kind of top-of-the-chart stuff and other months where it has tons of that? And, you know, how does that balance out on there are 18 new items this time from DC. Would there be, you know, 30 next month?
Yeah, I will say as a person that does read comics that way, there are times of the year that they push a lot of product. And I can tell you one of the main ones is right before the Christmas holiday. And that's obvious just for people are buying presents and things like that. So there are quite a few books released you know, middle of November, basically the first week after Thanksgiving starting, there's just a ton of books that come out. And almost, you know, I have to like budget extra for those couple months just because that's when they want those books in stores bright and fresh so people will see them and buy them.
Do you see a similar push right before the heart of the convention season?
Yeah, you definitely see, especially for the smaller independent publishers that you're probably not, you don't read as much of, such as Fantagraphics, Drawn in Quarterly, a lot of those smaller, Koyama Press, those guys make a huge amount of their revenue during the con season. They literally probably make a third or more of their revenue for the whole publishing, as they go through selling books at shows.
Wow, I believe that, certainly for those publishers.
If you've ever been to the more kind of like the, you know, Comic Arts Brooklyn or I think there's a big independent show up in Toronto, the Fantagraphics and Drawn and Quarterly booths are huge for those shows.
Well, and they have pretty sizable booths in San Diego as well.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those things that I think they have a bit more of a niche audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because they don't do the sorts of things that necessarily would turn into a summer blockbuster film or, you know, major TV series that could last for 10 years a la Smallville or some such.
Mm-hmm.
And that's great because there's an audience for those things. There's an audience for the niche stuff.
Yeah.
So the fact that they do such big business in such a focused time, it makes great sense for at the start of the convention season. You make sure you've got your new stuff out, collected, and ready to sell. And that carries you through that point.
Yeah. And actually, a lot of the smaller presses, actually, they use each of the cons to debut a new book or a series of books, like two or three. And they will oftentimes bring the author with them for signings to draw people to the booth. And then obviously they have a huge selection of a lot of their books. And it's just real common for a lot of the smaller independent publishers to do that.
It's a smart move.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were going to be a small publisher at San Diego or whatever convention, mm-hmm. I would want to have something newish.
Yeah.
And not necessarily so new as to steal the thunder for the stores that have pre-ordered it and don't have it yet.
Yeah, yeah.
Because that was a big problem for in San Diego at one point where, and this was back when I was living there, so 15, 20 years ago, there were a lot more retailers that were selling new comics. Mm-hmm. At Comic-Con, because it was still viable then. And you would have that, and you would have publishers that were bringing out books that had been printed but hadn't made it through the distribution chain yet. And then you would have some of the local stores, their sales are gutted for the next week or two. Because everybody's in San Diego at Comic-Con buying the stuff versus in San Diego at their store buying the stuff they pre-ordered.
Yeah. Now, I think that some of the publishers, at least the ones with experience, do a pretty good job of having solicited the book appropriately so that it'll come out either a week before or a week after the show that they're premiering it at. So that way the direct market doesn't get hosed. But another big reason why they like to do a huge portion of their sales at conventions is they sell the books for cover price, which when you live in a world of Amazon and Walmart and discount comic book service, the margins are a lot smaller when they sell to those vendors, because those vendors, to give us 40%, 50% off, they require a substantial discount from the publisher. And when you can sell a $25 book for $25 at a show, you make a lot more profit.
Well, it's interesting, and that's a great point to mention, because, I mean, retailers can get as deep as I think almost 60%, I think 59.5% mm-hmm. discount on stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So that means the publisher's got to be able to survive on 40% of the cover price.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Now,
some people are going to be thinking, well, man, they're making a killing then if they get that other 60% by charging that full price for that hardcover, that trade, whatever, at the show. And on the one hand, sure seems that way. On the other hand, at these shows, they've had to pay for the booth space. They've had to pay, obviously, for the printing, the shipping, and all that stuff to get those books there, the time and the money it takes to man the booth. And it's still one of those things that even with that advantage of not having middlemen, you've still got other costs that make it not as killer of a profit as it might seem at first glance. It's still better off for them. And the other advantage is it gives them a chance to talk to the audience and get some feedback, see what's working, see what people are excited about firsthand, and make some pretty informed decisions as to what they keep going with and what they don't.
Mm-hmm.
So it's and again, like you were saying, particularly in this world of Amazon, in stock trades, DCBS, which don't get me wrong, I love all three of those. I like getting discounts on my stuff, but I also see how from a publisher perspective, you know, only getting, you know, 40% of the cover price, man, that's a rough world to live in.
Yeah, no. So that's why they love selling a lot of inventory through those shows, because they can generally not have to worry about discounting, and that enables them to use a lot of that revenue to further publish books. Because remember, we're talking about, you know, these publishers don't have the backing of Disney and like Marvel does, or Warner Brothers like DC does. So a lot of these publishers have to be very careful of their margin. Obviously, they still want to sell to the, you know, Amazons and others, because those distributors just move so much product, but they do love the pure, you know, experience of selling the books. And, you know, a lot of times the books they sell to at fans are to the really hardcore fans, and those fans don't have a problem paying for it, because oftentimes they'll buy the book at full price, they'll get a drawing and a signature from the artist right there. So it's like a kind of like a quid pro quo kind of thing.
Oh, absolutely. And it can totally work out for everybody. And I think it's a good thing. But there are also, again, having just been to San Diego Comic-Con, things I see that I'm like, really? You decided to do that and you thought it was a good idea? There was one publisher that had just gotten a new property. I guess hasn't had enough time to get a full comic out. So what they did was 6 single-page comic, I guess would be the term to use, but a single page. Using the term comic book isn't appropriate, but comic, you know, page. They were selling them for $5 a shot.
Oh, wow.
6 single-page stories, with the other side, I guess, being the cover, if you will. Of course, it's a cover where you flip the thing over and that's the rest of the package. And, I mean, that could be highly profitable for them. It was a way quick-to-market kind of a thing, so I get that. It actually seemed like a cool idea. No way I was paying $5 a shot. I mean, $30 to get the full thing.
Yeah, that's expensive.
But, you know, they saw an opportunity. They took it. I can't fault them for that. I have no idea how well it worked for them. Hopefully it worked decently. Mm-hmm. And hopefully they will include those pages in whatever, you know, the full-blown packages they do, you know, when they publish the comics. But I think the variant stuff is another way that they leverage the face-to-face sales and try to get the excitement going. Because I can't tell you how many times I've seen, you know, an exclusive cover at San Diego for something, and it's, you know, $5 or $10, you know, markup on the comic.
Yeah.
But, you know, hey, they got to make their money so they stay in business. And when I see a lot of these sales, the way they're at, I mean, by the time we are at, what's a good breakoff point? Below rank 45, you're under 2,000 units on this list.
Mm-hmm.
And 2,000, 3,000, maybe 3,500 stores, only the top dozen or so are definitely getting a copy per store on average. And let's be realistic, they're not getting in every store. There are a lot of stores that are simply not going to order, which is, yeah, probably east of west, good chance. Ms. Marvel, I think a lot of stores would, but I'm willing to bet there are stores that just it doesn't sell. You know, by the time, well, House of Hem, that one at rank 8. I just was going through that night before. It is a reprint of the Fred Hembeck stuff.
Okay.
And it's great stuff, don't get me wrong. It's got the roast of the Fantastic Four, Fred Hembeck destroys the Marvel Universe, some other great stuff. But that, I think, is aimed towards a audience old enough to remember who he was, or is, to recognize the name and to go with it.
Yeah.
So a lot of stores, yeah, if it's a newer store, with a younger clientele, probably not going to have it, you know, and again, those are items in the top 10.
Yeah. Another interesting item is item 45,
mm-hmm.
which is, the DCBS exclusive version of the first trade of Witches, which was number 1, and they apparently ordered 2,000 copies just for themselves. And so that trade actually sold over 10,000 if you include those.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, so I saw that. That was pretty interesting. Number 45. It does have a pretty decent discount on it if you look at the retail rank, though.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's the same Yeah, same cover price as the other one. It sold less than a quarter, but yeah, it's that retail rank is pretty hefty. But, you know, if I were ordering 2,000 of a trade, mm-hmm. I would expect a pretty sweet deal.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just interesting to see. So, you know, so we think that they moved, you know, 8,946, which was the top selling trade, when in reality, because they had DCBS paid for those, you know, in this direct market, no returns, no backsies, the Witches actually sold about 10, almost 11,000 copies.
Just shy of 12,000.
Yeah.
11,000. You're right. All right. Sorry. Doing the math wrong. That is impressive. And it also gives a little bit of a potential size and scope of the business DCBS thinks they can do with that.
Absolutely.
And they may have some of them sitting on store shelves, or not store shelves, but you know what I mean, their shelf for in-stock trades or what have you.
Oh, absolutely. I'm sure a large portion of that will be sold through the in-stock trades. But the other interesting thing is that they actually also have a retail store themselves, don't they?
Yes. I believe they have a brick and mortar, yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a lot of stores I would see now doing that seems kind of questionable. But DCBS, again, I've been a customer of theirs for 12 years, mm-hmm. thereabouts. They know what they're doing. If they order 2,000, they know they've got a plan for it. They've either got sales for it or some kind of promotion, whatever, going.
Yeah, I agree.
I am favorably impressed with the way they run their stuff. What else do we have in here that's interesting?
Actually, you spoke about it a little bit earlier, but I actually, looking at the numbers, item number 4, Ms. Marvel Volume 3 Crushed, I just want to highlight that before this month's sales of reorder activity, the first month of reorder, the first month of sales were 7,091, and this month's reorder is 5,506. That is a huge amount of reorder activity, and really shows that there's some pent-up demand for that book. I mean, that is a lot of reorder. Considering what the initial order was, how close the reorder is, they're almost doubling their sales in 1 month.
It is also entirely conceivable that since I've focused more over the last year or two on cleaning the comic side than the trade side,
mm-hmm.
that this might be taking some of the sales from the previous Ms. Marvel series and lumping them in.
Ah, okay. Okay.
I would have to dig around to find out if that's the case.
Gotcha.
Because it's also saying the first ship date on this could be January of 2008.
Yeah.
Which could just be a problem with how it does the first ship date versus how it does the accumulation of the numbers.
Yeah.
You know, that's one of the things that is hard enough to deal with on the comic side. And I'll be honest, I don't have a good solution on the trade side yet. When I first put together the number crunching system, it was around 2000, actually. I started it when I moved out here to Austin. I'd been doing a little of it in San Diego, whatever. Anyways, back then, you had Ms. Marvel or you didn't. Now we've had how many different titles how many different volumes of that title? Same with some of the others. And it's, on the comic side, a little easier to track because I can use the price point to help differentiate the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But because they can give the same item different item codes and different printings can have different prices, it gets a lot harder to kind of clean up the trade side.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And of course, now I think we're hitting the point where certainly by this time next year, if not much sooner, we will probably have, say, the second first volume of Spider-Gwen that was released in 2015.
Yeah, that's true.
Because they've got the first thing, then after Secret Wars, they're doing another volume, and there are like half a dozen other books this way. It is just it's a real pain to track some of this, unfortunately.
Yeah, and the companies are doing you no favors, I'm sure.
I don't think they're doing themselves any favors. I mean, the fact that it's a nuisance to me, it bothers me, but really shouldn't bother anyone else. It's not their problem. But it's one of those things where if I say, gosh, TJ, Ms. Marvel is great, you should check out the third volume of the trade, it's just wonderful. And you go into a store, suppose you go into a store that had everything.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the Ms. Marvel section and you see at least two, possibly three or four Ms. Marvel Volume 3s. Which one do you get? Which one was I talking about?
Yeah, especially for the people that we want to bring into the market. You know, for an old grizzled vet like myself, I'd be able to either muddle my way through and figure out which one I wanted, or I would ask someone. Whereas someone who, you know, we want to expand the market might be much more intimidated or just not willing to go through the effort.
Or even if they're willing to go through the effort, they may not be able to answer the questions of who was the creator.
Yeah, that's true.
Which Ms. Marvel was it? And maybe it was, in that case, you could say, well, it's the Muslim one, the not Muslim one. Okay, that narrows it down.
Mm-hmm.
You get to Captain America or some of these other things that have had multiple volumes where they've got the same creator across different volumes.
That's true.
That's not a differentiating factor. Maybe it's the same character, maybe it's not. It's like you've got to have enough knowledge about the story.
Mm-hmm.
And again, the more casual reader, where the industry gets the biggest bang for the buck, if we can bring them in, are the harder ones to bring in. You know, I think it really is kind of counterproductive for the industry for some of these publishing practices.
I agree.
But it is what it is, and they've done what they've done. Oh, well. But man, it has made for a couple of interesting conversations at work, as I've tried to point some people toward some good stuff to read, because they've got the Marvel Digital Comics Unlimited.
Mm-hmm.
And just trying to describe, no, this is the one you want. I actually had one guy sitting there taking copious notes as I was trying to describe some of the Captain America stuff. You know, so hopefully we can get people in, but I can see that it's one of the bigger barriers to entry is just how, not inaccessible, but how needlessly convoluted it is. Mm-hmm. To have to describe the volume, the title, the comic or trade you're referring to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the other ones that's kind of interesting is down at rank 53. We've got Ant-Man Scott Lang trade paperback at 1,809 units. This is the recently completed five-issue mini. I don't know if it's a mini series or an ongoing. I'm going to say it's an ongoing that lasted five issues. Actually, no, I am incorrect. I was thinking it was a collection of that. What this is really, and I actually think I must have this over in that precarious stack. This is reprinting the early stuff of the Scott Lang Ant-Man. His early stuff in Marvel Premiere, Iron Man, Avengers, etc. But this goes back to unintentionally really good proof of my point of it's pretty damn confusing what's in some of these trades.
Uh-huh.
You know, I would have expected this, again, to have been the collection of the recently completed series, which I thought was getting followed up by another series of Ant-Man Larger Than Life, but that turned out to be a comic book reprint of early Hank Pym stories. So, and the sad thing is, I think I know what I'm talking about sometimes when it comes to comics. So for me to get this confused, I can't imagine somebody coming out of the movie thinking, wow, I want to read more of this stuff. Point me in the right direction.
Yeah, I've always thought that, unfortunately, Marvel has always done the least amount of work in trying to make their ideas and the direction they're going with their trade collections clear, you know, to the public. You know, I'm sure that they have some sort of a spreadsheet or whatever organizing all this, but a lot of times, you know, last time we talked about when they switched over to the Epic line from the Whites and how they decided to publish that, and a lot of these same kind of thought processes appear to be for all their collections. You know, they're just like, it'll be the next volume. We'll just keep going.
So, rank 16, Ant-Man Volume 1, Second Chance Man. That's the one that collects Ant-Man 1 through 5.
Okay.
That sold 3,327 units. Then we had the Ant-Man Scott Lang reprinting his early adventures. Then we also have Marvel's Ant-Man Prelude, which is a collection of the cinematic-ish stuff, down at rank 58 for 1,737 units. And then we have the Ant-Man Giant Man Epic Collection, A Man in an Ant Hill trade paperback, 1,318 units, which is collecting Tales to Astonish 27 and 35 through 59, which is interesting because the first two of those, 27 and 53, are, I think, what was in that Larger Than Life comic that just came out. And I think if I had realized that and the Epic Collection were coming out, I would have gotten the Epic Collection instead. And I may still. Again, five, because there's also an Marvel Universe Ant-Man Digest at rank 10, 3,877 units, collecting some of the Marvel Universe Avengers and whatnot stuff featuring Ant-Man. Right? He's got a movie, feature the character, get the stuff out in June for the movie and stuff in July. That makes perfect sense. But somebody coming in to the comic shop thinking, wow, I love this movie, give me something related. Which version, which character, you know, it's, again, too confusing.
Yeah, I agree.
But I suppose it's a good problem to have? I don't know.
Well, you know, they have their strategy. And, you know, on a certain level, you know, with how well they do in the single issues, they haven't been punished for what they do. You know, oftentimes they do fall behind in the trades. But to a certain extent, it seems like they've kind of accepted that and aren't willing to put the resources in to change that, you know?
Yeah, well, and the problem is, I think what they're doing on the monthly side is forcing them into a bad position on the trade side at Marvel.
Mm-hmm.
Because A-Force, Spider-Gwen, and a few others, and I'm blanking on what the others are titles that started in 2015, went for about 5 issues, Secret Wars hit, and they're going to relaunch them in 2015, presumably after Secret Wars. Now, what that means is you've got various titles that cannot go to a second trade paperback because the title didn't last long, or the volume didn't last long enough.
Mm-hmm.
And again, that's problematic, because imagine going to that magical bookshelf in the magical bookstore, you know, a few years from now, and all you see is, you know, 7 or 8 different volume ones of Spider-Gwen, you know, and that that seems ludicrous, doesn't seem impossible, you know. Again, you could certainly do that already for Captain America and a few other characters. I just think they're positioning themselves in a way where, again, finding what you want on of their collected stuff is getting harder and harder. And I've got to imagine that problem compounds itself digitally, which essentially is that magical bookshelf on that magical bookstore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's got everything. It's just, can you find it? And for me, I used to, well, and still do on the comic side, I use the launch year as kind of the differentiating factor. That's no longer enough because the half-life on a comic is so short.
Well, it is going to be interesting, too, because they oftentimes will do that, Marvel especially, for their digital organization on the Marvel Unlimited app, oftentimes will use the year to differentiate between, you know, all the different versions of Hulk or all the different versions of Spider-Man or Amazing Spider-Man. But you're right, if they keep shortening these series, they're going to have to come up with another way of doing it.
I mean, it's not a new problem.
Yeah.
DC hit that with Superboy and maybe one other title in 2011, because they had relaunched the Superboy title at January, and then that September they relaunched everything, you know. But it's one thing for it to be an isolated title here or there, or the second Batwoman number 0 issue or something like that.
Uh-huh.
But when it starts to be line-wide and systemic, you know, with all of the Secret War stuff, we're now getting a second Old Man Logan number 1, a second Civil War number 1, and that stuff. Now, these are clearly cover marked as being part of the Secret Wars stuff, but when you've got, you know, every event title du jour, or, you know, over the years, or whatever you want to say, reused at this point, again, it's adding to the confusion in the marketplace.
I agree.
But again, it's easy to say that, but it's hard to really recommend what they should be doing instead. I do think the Epic Collection idea is a great idea. I would like to see DC do something similar. If I thought it would work, I would suggest they do it in more of almost a yearbook kind of a format.
Mm-hmm.
And just say, okay, this title started at this week of whichever year, so that's going to be the week we decide, you know, go for 52 weeks, boom. Collect that, however many issues it is, rinse, repeat, with a little bit of a fudge factor if, well, you just need another couple to round it out.
Mm-hmm.
Because, man, I would love it if they did the equivalent of an Epic Collection for, I'm trying to think what would be some really good stuff that I don't know, you know, Flash, Green Lantern, that kind of stuff, when those things were coming out of the, you know, the Silver Age and whatnot. You know, again, it goes towards the Showcase collections, but they were black and white. Just like the Epic stuff is replaced pretty much the Essential line, DC should do the same.
Oh, I agree. I think the Epic, you know, I actually don't own any of the Epics. I've seen them in the store, but they, I do like them better, you know, in color for sure.
Well, I picked up the Iron Fist one. I've literally just picked it up, and it's a nice collection. It's good paper stock. I'm not going to say it's brilliant or whatever, but it's full bleed on the covers and not so much on the interior. So it's pretty easy to tell essentially where the chapter breaks are, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The reproduction quality looks pretty good. It feels comfortable. And it's, in this case, wow, over 500 pages.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got Marvel Premiere 15 through 25, Iron Fist 1 through 15, Marvel Team Up 63, 64. So, I mean, for me, you've got the full color comic reproduction here. That's a hard package to turn down. But it goes also back to your point of Marvel not doing a good job of really communicating what their game plan is.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think if I had realized that was the plan for the Epic stuff, I probably would have jumped on board. But, you know, they didn't, so their loss. All right, let's filter out Marvel and DC and see what else we got to talk about. Up at the top of the list, we've got a lot of Image stuff that we've talked about. Let's filter them out for a minute, because that's quickly going to get to be the usual suspects. So if we take Image out as well, we're down to 108 items, so about a third of the list. Topping that, interesting, Dynamite Entertainment's Project Superpowers Chapter 2 Volume 1 trade paperback.
Mm-hmm.
Reorder activity, 2,500 units of that. Huge, really large retail rank. So it invoiced for, I'm going to say, roughly a third, but significantly less than the same priced item right below it, which is Viz Naruto Volume 70.
Mm-hmm.
Which is actually pretty high placement for that. Naruto obviously been around forever, but for a while it seemed to kind of be at the top of the list and then kind of drop off the radar, at least my radar, for a bit. What else do we have in here that looks interesting?
The first trade of The Big Trouble in Little China. You know, that's one of my favorite movies from when I was a kid. And I thought the comic has been pretty decent. And about, you know, 1,668 copies. It's not a bad start. We'll see if there's much reorder activity. But, you know, I'm a pretty big fan. And Boom does a pretty decent job of pricing those trades. That one's $14.99. So,
how many issues does that collect?
I believe four.
Interesting. For four, it seems a little more pricey than I personally would like for four.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a bad price.
Oh, I actually agree. But compared to a company like IDW, which prices their Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles for four issues at $17.99, it's you know, decently cheaper. So
that's a very good point.
Yeah, I've always found that IDW, and maybe this just is how their licensing system works in their contracts, IDW almost always tries to do trades or four issues or five at the most, especially for licensed material. And they either have them at $17.99 or $19.99. If they have some creator-owned stuff or stuff that, you know, the print versions of the Monkey Brain stuff, that they'll have a little bit more reasonable prices. But yeah, IDW does not play around. When they charge you $3.99 for a single issue, they oftentimes will translate that straight to trade.
Well, it makes sense to do that, because if you've got it cheaper in trade than in single issues, you're telling people not to buy the single issues.
Yeah, which in some ways is Image's entire business model with their first trade.
Fair point. But I think that's a matter of them seeing the long term.
Mm-hmm.
And it was something they really kind of, I think, you know, proved out with Walking Dead and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one thing to say, okay, the introductory one, cheap, go from there, you know, put it back up to a regular price, which is what they do. But I think also a lot of these other publishers are, less so with Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and Big Trouble in Little China. I was going to say they were going with miniseries or something, at which point you can't really kind of do a door buster on the first one.
Yeah, no, exactly.
But then you look at some of these other things. I don't know, I just, a four-issue trade seems a little thin to me.
The way they usually fill them out is that, especially for some of the smaller publishers like Boom or IDW, they still end up, you know, with about 128 to 160 paid trades. And the way they do it is they put a lot of these comics, especially number ones in these series, have a bunch of variants. So they'll have all the variants that they printed. Oftentimes they'll have sketches. Oftentimes they'll have maybe an interview with the creators. And oftentimes, if they want to even pad it a little more, they'll actually give you the written script that the artist drew for like the first issue or one of the issues. And that's a way that these companies fill out that trade when you're absolutely right. Without it, you'd get almost like a 100-page comic, you know, trade. So,
well, I've got really mixed feelings on that because I think it's a cool thing to do for the people who get the trade.
Mm-hmm.
It's not really a cool thing for the people who bought the individual issues, allowing you to pay for the content creation and therefore put the trade together.
Yeah. Well, from my perspective, it's funny to hear you say that because my perspective is actually a little different. I don't mind that they do that in the sense that I understand that they need to make the book a little heftier for the amount that they're charging. Otherwise, people really will start to question their, you know, the content versus price. I actually don't get a lot out of the extras, except for certain artists that I actually really like follow intently. Like J.H. Williams III extra material I always enjoy. But a lot of times it's just like for me, and this is just me personally, I understand there are some people that literally this is the whole reason they buy DVDs and Blu-rays is the extra bits. For me, I watch the movie and maybe 5% of the time do I look at the extras or any of that. You know, people that buy the Criterion Collection are probably, you know, aghast at me, but because that's one of the big draws for things like that was the extras. But for me, I want the story. All that extra stuff I feel is for them to try and justify their 4-issue price.
No, and I agree with that, and I think they kind of have to do something to justify that price. But having again spend the money on the individual issues, yeah, it's not worth it for me just to get the bonus material, and if that's the only way I can.
Yeah. Well, a counterexample actually is something that creators like Ed Brubaker and the guys that do Sex Criminals do. They do certain things that they only keep in the issues that they won't reprint in the trades to incentivize people to buy their single issues. So Ed Brubaker, oftentimes for his Criminal series or his the previous series before the one he's working on right now, but he would have basically the noir series he did, he would have contributors or himself write about noir history or how he kind of came to be interested in this and give kind of like some background and stuff. But it was like an essay, but not just like him rambling. It was like kind of like a researched essay.
Mm-hmm.
And as well as like a pretty solid letter page with a lot of back and forth. And that stuff was reserved for the single issue readers and wouldn't be reprinted in the trade to try and incentivize the reverse.
Yeah. And there are others who have done similar things.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a great idea. And those tend to be the creators that realize if those issues don't sell,
yeah,
they can't get enough of them done to get to that trade.
Yeah, exactly.
And, you know, it makes sense. It's something where I could see the trade people saying, well, how come I don't get the full package? It's like, I get that. But frankly, I've got a little less sympathy on that side.
Mm-hmm.
Since, by and large, the trades, I don't say are icing on the cake. Sometimes they're the only thing that make a comic continue.
Mm-hmm.
But if it's not doing well enough on the monthly side, it doesn't get to that trade paperback.
Yeah. Or it only gets one, and then it basically, you know.
Yeah.
You can't continue. No, I agree. And that is the eternal question that you see played out in the comment section of almost every article about a series being canceled is all you trade waiters, you killed our series, you know, and all the single issue people complaining and all the trade waiters said, you know, saying, well, oftentimes books that don't sell well in singles don't sell well in trade either. It's kind of like a chicken or egg problem, you know?
Well, and I don't think readers should blame other readers for a comic not succeeding.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, you look at some of these things where the trade sales are unimpressive or really impressive and therefore keeping a so-so monthly title going and stuff. The bottom line is publishers are giving us, the readers, the chance to buy it in print. Well, let's take the full spectrum. Potentially buy it digitally as they serialize it. Buy it in print as they collect the digital versions, if it was originally done digitally or not, or just straight to the print. Buy it in a hardcover, a trade paperback, possibly an omnibus.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and even if it's not digital first, they take the print and do it in digital time and time. So that's like 4 or 5 opportunities we've got to buy it in different ways, shapes, or form, depending what works best for us personally.
Or if you get to the end of the line with Kirkman, his like compendiums, you know, 30 or 40 issues at a time too.
Yes, he's taken it to an art form.
Yeah.
Because he also did the reprint in comic format with The Walking Dead Weekly.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Hat off to him. I mean, the guy, and he could publish it 6 ways to Sunday, literally, and it sold.
Yeah. The other interesting thing, too, I don't know if you've noticed being solicited in Image, he's actually also translating into Spanish, and but not the single issues, just the, you know, what he would initially sell as the $14.99 6-issue trades. He's translating all those to Spanish, and every 3 months, I think he's releasing one. And, you know, obviously he's only up to like the fourth or fifth trade, but that takes that material that's already been completely amortized over all the other and translating it into Spanish. And then obviously there are other languages that are hundreds of thousands of readers around the world.
I had not known that. That's brilliant.
Yeah. So he has, I think they've solicited three or four of the first three or four trades, you know, the 6 issues each and in Spanish. So
do those show up here on the list at all?
Ooh, that's a good question. I would assume they have a different ISBN as a trade, you know, because they'll be differentiated in the bookstore. But I don't know how that would translate within the Diamond system and within the retailers, because I don't expect a lot of comic book stores to sell, you know, a large amount of the Spanish product, but maybe a lot of bookstores do, like Amazon or other stores.
I can see, though, LA, San Diego, yeah. El Paso, Austin, Houston, San Antonio, you know, kind of the Mexican border, if you will,
mm-hmm.
Having a lot of interest in that. And again, if that opens it up to a new audience,
mm-hmm.
That's great.
Well, and that's what's so smart about slicing that pie like that is, you know, obviously the absolute honest truth is the single greatest property, obviously outside of DC and Marvel in terms of Batman and things like that, is The Walking Dead in comics. I mean, the amount of money he's made from that over the last years is incredible, and he's able to use that as capital to get things translated, because it's not cheap to translate things. But he has obviously plenty of money to do it, and it just opens up a new revenue stream that he had that was generating zero before, and now it's positive, you know.
Well, and given how many times he's reprinted the same material, yeah, with no additional effort,
yeah,
to take the time to get it translated into Spanish, relettered, and all that kind of stuff, because you may have to tweak the balloons. It's not trivial.
Mm-hmm.
But it opens it up to a whole new audience.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, there's 23,536 units of Walking Dead trade paperbacks this month alone.
Mm-hmm.
Across all, that's the total of all 23 of those volumes that showed up on the list.
Mm-hmm.
To say this thing has legs doesn't even begin to sum it up.
Yeah. And the crazy thing to think about is that's A, 1 month, and that's B, just in the direct market. Imagine how many he's selling in other markets too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
This is something where I don't know, you know, how to translate. I can't translate the book scan numbers into units.
Yeah.
But this is the kind of stuff that is moving through Barnes & Noble, any other brick-and-mortar stores, Amazon. It's the kind of thing, as new volumes come out, I would be tempted, were I in charge of the right places, to say, hey, put it on the book stand at the airports.
Mm-hmm.
And those are some of the most brutal competitive shelf space there is.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely.
But it's got the audience.
Oh, absolutely. Especially with how well the TV show does. I mean, in fact, outside of like Sunday Night Football, it has the best ratings on of any television show in the all of television, cable, network, anything.
Interesting.
Yeah. Walking Dead is the number one non-football television show on all of TV when it's on.
When Sam and I have talked the numbers, we haven't really talked either AMC or Walking Dead.
Yeah. And, so, and I'm speaking about the, you know, 18 to 49, the demo, the ones that the advertisers actually care about. Yeah.
Right, right. Interesting.
Yeah. No, it basically gets over, I think, a 6 or a 7, which if when you talk to Sam, he'll say is enormous.
Oh, yeah.
For today.
That's huge.
Yeah. And I think Sunday Night Football or Monday Night Football, I can't remember, you know, gets 7 to 8. So that's the only thing that beats it, basically.
Well, and again, you take the second most common language in the United States, or at least what I perceive to be the second most popular, mm-hmm. Spanish, open it up to that audience. I mean, why not?
Mm-hmm.
That's that. I hadn't realized he was doing it. That is a smart move.
Yeah. Yeah, and like I said, I think he's releasing one every 3 or 4 months, you know, so that gives, you know, not one every month, you know, so that gives the audience time to space out and you know, have an appropriate amount of time to absorb the material, which I think is smart.
Oh, absolutely. And it means basically on $5 a month, you could be saving it up, getting the next trade, save it, get the next.
Yeah.
You've had and time to read it, enjoy it, and move on. Yeah. Yeah.
And he's keeping the price the exact same, you know, in terms of, and obviously if it's in foreign markets, I don't know what the price translates to, but they're still, you know, the $14.99, you know, 6-issue trade. So.
Yeah. No, he's really proven out a lot of ways things can be done in comics and stuff, both in terms of storytelling and in terms of how to package the material.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's was one of the first, not just to do, I mean, other people were doing the, hey, it's a 6-issue arc, collect it, move on. But to then say, okay, two of those trades equals a hardcover, two of the hardcovers equals the compendium, two of the, you know, at some point he's just going to have the lead weight where you get the whole collection in one shot. I mean,
mm-hmm.
if he ever ends the series, mark my words, he will do a maybe not slipcase, but a complete set sort of a run in 6 different variations.
Absolutely.
And he should.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if it's not his retirement plan, I would be surprised. What else do we have in here? We've got a lot of different things. Actually, one that I want to point out, 257, it's Bloodshot Volume 6, Glitch and Other Tales Trade Paperback. It is collecting, am I looking at the right thing? Bloodshot 24, 25, the Director's Cut, and one or some other stuff. All right, I was thinking it was a full-blown trade. It's just collecting a couple of stories. 611 units. What else has Valiant got this time around? Because they're one of those where I think their comic sales aren't, you know, burning up the charts. Rye is the only other thing they've got. It did 1,018 units, and that collected Rise 5 through 8. That's another one doing kind of 4-issue collections.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're writing the stuff geared towards that, but I don't know if I would suggest that's the right approach.
Well, I think one of the other issues for Rye is they have Clayton Crane doing the art, and he does this really amazing digital painting, and I think it's pretty time intensive. So I think he comes on for an arc and then is gone for a month or two, or they kind of slow the series down kind of thing. So I think that might be also an issue, and the reason they put him out at 4 issues is to kind of amortize that cost as well.
And that makes sense, because you're right. He's got a very involved style.
Yeah, it's his work is gorgeous. It just takes time.
You know, it's funny, because I think it's gorgeous, but that book isn't clicking with me as much as I was hoping it would.
Mm-hmm.
And I do attribute some of that to the art style. And not, it's bad art. It is not. It's beautiful art. But it is almost more photorealistic-ish. It's not totally photorealistic, but it's, again, more of that style than typical comic art tends to be, and therefore it doesn't feel natural as a comic book to me.
Gotcha.
You know, I've had similar things when people have tried to do computer graphics that look very 3D video game realistic-ish, but still clearly video gaming, you know, computer-generated stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of that uncanny valley. It's close but not right.
Yeah.
So yeah, those are the main things that kind of caught my attention this time around. I am going to be curious a couple of months out when we start getting collections of the Convergence stuff and Secret Wars.
Yeah, I think we're definitely, especially for the big two, we're in somewhat of a holding pattern on the trade side. I think it is very interesting to discuss the comic side, you know, but right now we're kind of waiting for all that stuff that you guys have been talking about to filter into the trades. And especially for DC, I really am interested to see how those Convergence sell. I will give them credit for making them relatively cheap for how, you know, they're 240 pages for $19.99 before discount, and you know that those will be 50% off through the retailers like DCBS. So you are getting quite a chunk of story, but I'm still a little hesitant and worried for them in terms of how they're going to be able to do that for collected.
Well, what I'm expecting right before we get those is we should be getting in the next couple of months on these lists all of the collections of the stuff that was wrapping up right before Convergence.
Oh, okay.
So, you know, that Clarion run, the Batgirl stuff with the Babstar art and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a little bit of a influx of sales. Then we're going to have that Convergence stuff. And then it may be a little bit before they've, again, accumulated enough to do the next set of collections.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think when they have a 2-month pause like that at DC, it really, I would assume, puts the people doing the collected editions into an uncomfortable position of, well, all the stuff we've got you know, for what finished prior to convergence, but we don't want to release it all at once because it's got to hold us for a bit. Not just the okay, we've got the first month, well, we got nothing finishing up because convergence just started. Next month, okay, we've got everything finishing up, but that's got to hold us for another 6 months till we get enough to collect everything else coming out of convergence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it puts a again that cadence for how the trades are released. Normally not that big of a deal, but with DC having, when they launched the new 52, now with the convergence pause, that kind of stuff, it throws a bit of a monkey wrench into the things.
Mm-hmm.
Same over at Marvel right now with everything having stopped for Secret Wars. So it's really put the main two in a very unprecedented position, I think, in terms of the pacing of their output. Obviously, I think Image has been able to leverage that a bit. They did really well this time around, bumped DC out of the top 10 with Marvel's help. Don't know if that'll continue or whatnot, but it's an opportunity for the other publishers to kind of squeeze in at particular times. I mean, if I were the guys over at Boom, Dark Horse, Dynamite, Valiant, I would be paying close attention to what comics DC and Marvel had published leading up to Convergence and Secret Wars, what trades they've solicited, and what gaps they kind of have in the next 6 months in their what you would expect them to release.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can time the release of a couple of things well, you could easily get some stuff high on the list. You know, and that's kind of gaming the system to a degree, but, you know, hey, that's what these sorts of lists are for to a degree.
Yeah. Well, and I think it would especially behoove some of those publishers to plan a little ahead like that, where in these summer months, kind of in the summer doldrums for releasing stuff, they might have a product that can shine a little bit through the, you know, waves that Marvel and DC publish. Like I said, in November and December, it's very hard for the independent guys to kind of put out product because DC and Marvel are just dumping tons of books on the market.
Normally, yes. But again, with Convergence having ended and new books starting in July,
mm-hmm.
for them to get a six-issue arc out, they're not going to have that story done until December.
Yeah, that's true. It'll be interesting to see the solicits for that those couple months.
Exactly. And a clever marketing and collection edition person at some of these other publishers may be able to find opportunities where there's kind of an opening on the field for them to get something and really do well with it. Because I don't know how trade readers budget their money and how much is pre-order, Amazon, or just, hey, I'm at the store, what do I see that's new in trade this week?
Mm-hmm.
But for the people who are, hey, what's new in trade this week at the store, and you're saying, well, geez, there's nothing from Marvel and DC, but wow, that looks really cool over there. You know, that's an opening these other publishers could leverage. And mm-hmm. not just for the one sale, but if they're got the right material, that could be something they could then get a reader hooked on their stuff moving forward.
Makes sense.
But I think those opportunities are few and far between and hard to leverage. But, you know, there's potentially one coming up.
Yeah, so. It's a small window, if you will.
Yeah. And really, all you need to do is get your foot in the door, get your material sometimes seen by the right people.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a pivotal time, I think, for Marvel and DC. I think it's also pivotal for a few other publishers. One of the ones I would say actually right now is Red 5 Comics.
Mm-hmm.
They're a small publisher. They've been doing some great stuff over the last, 8 years now, thereabouts? Long time. One of their major properties, Atomic Robo, has moved on to, I think it's IDW?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, you know, they need to do something to kind of fill that gap or that slot, if you will, in their publishing stuff. And it's an opportunity for them to say, you know, we've done other stuff. Here's some great material. Let's run with this. And if they could get a good property to the audience at the right time and there's not much competition for Marvel, DC, or there's an opening there, that could be a game changer for them. So it's lots of opportunities to be had, but also just a really bizarre time in comics.
Yeah, with ever more and more material coming out.
Yeah.
Yeah, sometimes I look at my wish list. You know, I keep an Amazon wish list with all the stuff that, you know, comes out that I don't have a chance to order, or I'm like, ooh, that's a big ticket item. Maybe I'll save that for a birthday gift or a Christmas thing. And the list doesn't ever seem to shrink.
Yeah. Yeah. I tend not to put stuff on the wish list. Either I get it or I don't. But that's why I've got, again, a bookcase that's about to collapse under its own weight and a large stack of comics to be reading.
Yeah, that makes sense.
The price points were all over the place this time. We had in the top 300, let's see, we had 28 different price points. Eking out as most popular was $14.99 with 67 items on the list. The next most popular was $19.99 with 42 items on the list. And then $24.99 with 39 items on the list. And that accounts for not quite half the stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's just a smattering of everything else from $9.99, which actually hit 31 items. So that puts us a little below 60% of the list there. But everything as low as $4.99 up to $125. And that $4.99 was actually a Comic Book Legal Defense Fund Defender number 2 bundle of 25 from, I believe, Comics Tribe. But I would have to double check. Yeah, that should be Comics Tribe, all right. Interesting. So, again, you could argue it's a collected edition because it's a bundle of 25. But really, that's a comic by and large. And then at the other end of the spectrum, up near that $100 price point is, wow, we've got, talk about spacing things out. Marvel released the Star Wars Marvel Years Omnibus Volume 2 hardcover, the Annihilation Conquest Omnibus hardcover, and both in the same month, going opposite the Absolute Transmetropolitan Volume 1, the JSA Omnibus Volume 3, all of which were $125. And we had the Complete 8-Ball Box Set Issues 1 through 18 from Fantagraphics for a little under $120. And the Don Rosa Life and Times of Scrooge McDuck Artist Edition Volume 1 from IDW for $95. That one I picked up.
Yeah, that looks like a gorgeous volume of the artist editions.
Yeah, I'm waiting for them to solicit the other one, at least Volume 2. And they could possibly do a third because they had a companion to the Life of Times of Scrooge McDuck.
Ah, I didn't know that.
Have you read the stuff, the original material?
Yeah, I have read some of it. I haven't read a bunch of it, but yeah.
They did, again, a nice set of hardcovers, some trades and stuff. Did a back issue spotlight on that ages ago. Great stuff. It is like the quintessential Scrooge McDuck.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people, if they're not into it, may not check it out, and they should. It's one of those that really kind of showcases what comics can be, and why you shouldn't just ignore something because it's talking ducks.
Yeah,
it is. It's really well done talking ducks, though.
Yeah, and Fantagraphics does a great job with those hardcovers. You know, in the more reasonably priced ones, the artist editions obviously are usually IDW, mm-hmm. but I've read the material in the hardcover editions, and they're really well put together. So
yeah. Anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for this month.
Cool. The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If they differ from your reality, please verify you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes two decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there's at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, list of top graphic novels in collected editions contained only 50, 25, or 2 scanned items. This means that historical data about graphic novels in collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels in collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the alternate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.